Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for tuning in to our virtual event with our good friend Harlan Coben. It's always great to see you, Harlan.
Thanks, Patrick.
And Barbara's holding up a copy of the brand new book, Think Twice. And I understand that our signed copies will be here very shortly. So what I'm going to do is put a link in the comments field should you wish to purchase one of the few remaining ones. We don't have very many left. But if you have questions for Harlan, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will bring me back on screen. And I think it's going to be a little bit shorter evening tonight, maybe 40 minutes or so. So I'll be here waiting for you to call me back. So over to you, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I want you to look at this very cool typeface. I really like what they did to the eyes. Is that your idea, Harlan, or was that the production department?
I think it was their idea. It was kind of a way of hinting at Myron and Wynne. We, I
It
think,
is.
wanted to figure a way of putting them into the font, and so that's what they came up with.
I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it
So,
looks cool.
this book does not actually go on sale until Tuesday, the 14th, but I'm going to drink a little toast to Harlan because this is a preview event in my fabulous decorated water glass. So, ooh.
Hope everybody out there is having a drink too. I should have brought a glass, but I'm okay.
Well, you could have done that. I mean, we don't have dry
Yeah.
events. Come on, Harlan. So, I must say that I would have liked this book better if the Phoenix Suns had not managed to eliminate themselves from the playoffs because the Suns are a crucial part of this story, which involves a lot of basketball. So it kind of warmed my heart that you made it Phoenix, but I thought at the time that if they had actually gone the distance, it would have been more fun to read this. Why'd you pick Phoenix?
Just I think because that's part of the book, they were near Vegas, and I was trying to think of a team near Vegas. It's not often a very specific reason, and it was only one game they went to the. They just mentioned there's no scene there really. They have a photograph of somebody who was attending a Phoenix Suns game. That's a clue. So for all of you Phoenix people out there, that's a little wink and a nod.
It is. Well, actually, it's a bit of a pivot too for the story. But anyway, at least in
Yes.
Phoenix. So we get Myron back again and Wynne. And Harlan and I talked during COVID about his book. I think it was actually called Wynne, wasn't it?
We did have a book called Win. I'm not sure. Yeah, it came out during COVID. That's right.
It
We
did.
had
I mean, it
Boyfriend
was.
was the first one I had COVID, and Win was the second one I had during COVID. So yeah.
Right. This is your 36th book, and I think that Harlan and I have Zoomed since 2020. So one of these days, I'm hoping to lure him back to
Back.
Phoenix, maybe during the basketball season, so that we could go to a game.
If the Suns were
Right.
still playing, maybe we could have gotten tickets and gone.
There you are. Would have been terrific. Anyway, Wynn was the focal point of Wynn, surprisingly. But in this, Myron's backstory really comes into play. So, do you want to give us like an elevator pitch for this?
Well, I try to create this book as though it were a standalone. I was actually thinking about when I think of my favorite series, almost none of them I read in order.
Yeah.
People always say, "Oh, you know this better than I do. How many people come in and need to have the read the first book first and second book?" But most of my favorite series I haven't. I was actually thinking about Robert Parker's Spencer series, for example. Where if I had probably read the Godwolf manuscript first, I'm not so sure. I didn't love that particular book as much as some of the others. I think I started with Ceremony or Mortal Stakes or one of those and
Mortal Stakes, that's the
so
best
much.
one. Hands down, the
Yeah.
baseball one.
I love Ceremony too. So
Yeah.
anyway, my point being that I kind of wanted to start this book for people who had never read Myron that you could read it. And if you started the series with Deal Breaker, he's 28 years old. In this book, he's closing in on late 40s to 50 without mentioning specifically. But every time you start a book, the guy had a whole life before. So
Right.
one of the challenges when you do a series is how do you start a guy fresh for people who have never read him, and yet for those who have, not repeat yourself. And I think this book did it. First of all, it's been 8 years, I think, or 9 years since I wrote a Myron Bolitar book. So it was easier for me to sort of step back, start him anew. Start him and Wynne and Esperanza and all of them in a different place and really reach for some emotion and for some poignancy in their aging that I thought would be interesting place to take Myron and Wynne at this particular time in their lives.
Yeah, well, I think you did it particularly well with Esperanza. you know, because she's not Myron and Wynn, but she was still an integral part of the agency.
Yep.
And now I thought when, you know, Myron closed the agency and then he comes back, but he still gets off on the fourth floor of the building, where Esperanza is now working differently. And so, you know, it's true that if you mentor people, you know, that you would like them to move on and do things with your life. But at the same time, he clearly misses her. I thought that was a really, really strong part of the story.
Thanks. I mean, you know, life changes and so does for Myron and Wynn and the whole team and his parents too. You know, Myron's parents are getting older. They've moved to Florida now. When I first started the series Deal Breaker, Myron actually lived in the basement of the house where his parents lived upstairs. And now we've reached the stage where his parents are, you know, 80 years old and retired to Boca Raton and have a few scenes that I love. But also, look, I'm always about the twists and turns. I'm always about trying to grip you. So really the idea kind of came, I had read an article, this sounds strange, but I read an article about how it's rare now. Serial killers are getting rarer and rarer, not because we have great mental health in this country. Lord knows, we know it's not that. But because it's so hard to get away with it nowadays, everybody's so easy to track, both victim and, you know, assailant. Everybody has a phone. Everybody is on GPS. Everybody is filmed 8,000 times a day on CCTV. Everybody goes through Easy Pass. So it's very difficult. You know, in those old days, you'd have the killer meet the girl in a park and no one would know where she was. That really is not very realistic now. So the challenge for me is, I hate serial killer books. I don't write them. I don't read them. But how can I write one that I liked that I can be clever enough to get around the new technology? And that was sort of the start. And then one of the ways was to bring make the killer appear to be somebody who was long dead, who Myron knew. And so that's how Myron gets involved in the case. And so still the most important thing to me is making sure that this is a compelling, gripping story. I think this, more than any other book I've ever written, by the early response, no one, you know, not figuring out who the killer is. And of course, having the emotional resonance. I want that ending to put a little tear in your eye. And I hope that's what all those things are what I'm trying to accomplish.
You know, years ago, there was a vineyard in Napa Valley. I can't emphasize this too much because it's sort of a spoiler, but it was called Folie à Deux. And it was basically about two probably San Francisco entrepreneurs long before the tech bros or something, who decided their mutual folly would be to open a vineyard. And I love the French. I've always thought Folie à Deux sounds so much better than any other way that you could phrase relationships. But I've always, you know, I've always thought that was an interesting psychology. So, you know, I just throw that out there. But let's go back to what I found really fun is that when the DNA arrives at Myron's door, so to speak, and it appears that his longtime, I don't even know what we want to call him, but
I guess you can call him a frenemy, if you will. You know, his longtime rival turned enemy turned friend.
Right. And a long history with Myron's first love and Myron's, you know, on and on. Anyway, when it arrives, it suggests that maybe Greg was at the crime scene. Maybe Greg was the killer. But Myron goes, no, I did the eulogy at his funeral. You know, no, he's dead. He can't be. What I really liked was that when he talked to Wynn about it, Myron's so shocked. Wynn isn't shocked at all. So, I mean, right there, we already know that Wynn does not share everything with Myron.
The relationships, it's been interesting. The relationship had been strained in the last few Myron books. Strained for them, but there's deep love. It sounds corny, but the Myron, if somebody asks me over the course of all these years, and the first Myron came out almost 30 years ago, what these books are about, it's really about the friendship between Myron and Wynn. Yes, Esperanza. Yes, his parents. Yes, Big Cindy. Yes, there's always a crime. But where, you know, most detective series are about one man or maybe a man and his sidekick. In the end of the day, Wynn has grown into such a part that it's really often about their friendship and about their relationships. And that was the reason I kind of wanted to write this book now. It's we're in a really bad, you know, not to get world event stuff, but it's a bad time in America and in the world, really. And there's nothing wrong with, like, I kind of wanted to, this book, I want it to be like a little vintage, you know, like a little throwbacky, still modern and all that stuff. But I wanted you to enjoy just the time with Myron and Wynne. The times when Myron and Wynne are just, and there's a scene when Myron, Wynne, and Esperanza are all just sitting in the apartment, going through the case, having a drink, doing the things they do. And that even if there wasn't a mystery, you would just enjoy spending the time with these characters. I think the most harrowing scene in this book involves Myron's parents. So that's sort of what I wanted, to give you a little bit more than just the mystery. I wanted that kind of warm, cozy feeling that I get from a favorite book when I can sit down with a favorite series character. And, you know, for those who've read them before, you're just going to dive right in. For those who haven't, I think this is a really good introduction. And then you'll go back and you'll discover how he got here.
That's very true. Myron's mother has some mouth on her.
She really she's based on my mom, so I can think that I'll agree.
Did you actually have that kind of discussion with your mom? I'd be interested to know.
Some of that, yeah. Sometimes she was, yeah, at least she could horrify me pretty
right,
good.
Retiring to Florida is very rejuvenating. She's yeah. So funny. But anyway, you know, but it's also... it's really useful to have somebody like Wynne, who, you know, has untold resources at his command, so that is possible in the course of a book that moves in space. This is not all in New Jersey. The book actually, as we've already indicated, it comes west, goes to Phoenix, goes to Las Vegas, circles back, blah, blah. They have somebody that can, like, just summon up his jet and, yeah, you know, and move people around, which means that you were able to bring a character in to play that under conventional travel wouldn't really have happened, but because Myron can just send the jet, you know, there he is. I'm sorry, Wynne can just send the jet. So Wynne's really useful in many respects. But, you know, we explored Wynne and his money and his life and all in Wynne, which I thought was one of the best conversations we've had.
Thanks. Well, I agree with you. You know, also, I've written Myron now for a long time, and this particular book, I wanted a few new settings. I didn't just want to be staying in New York and New Jersey. So as you point out, in this Phoenix, there's a Vegas, there's Montana, there's a few spots that they can go to easily enough because Wynne has the private plane. I don't know if it's a convenience. I would just kept the story probably tighter, but I thought it'd be interesting to go a few different places. I wanted to spread this world out a little bit. This is a big conspiracy. This killer is working in a lot of different areas. I also, the book opens in second person. So I think, like, the first line, I'm not reading it, but I'm just remember it myself. But the first line of the book is, here is how you destroy a life. You stand over his bed and watch him sleep, blah, blah, blah. The second person, which I've never done.
Yeah.
Third person, most of the book is third person from Myron's viewpoint. And then there's sections that are first person present tense from Wynne's viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges for me, well, I didn't like plan it necessarily that way, but, you know, being able to combine those without jarring you out of where you are. And I think there's one time when we move to first person when that will be particularly shocking to people who read the book, not giving anything away. But I thought that was also, I'm always looking for ways of changing things up and trying to make it better. I mean, it sounds corny, but I think Think Twice is the best Myron book I've ever written. Well, I think that tomorrow, probably not, but I change my mind all the time. Anyway, it's always the goal.
Sure. Well, and it also keeps you interested. You know, otherwise they would get really stale. I did like the second person, and it's not just in the prologue. It's basically the killer, you know, saying to us, you know, here's what I'm doing, and God, I'm so clever, and what a great planner I am, and all, you know, I mean, it's the ego of the killer that we're hearing, and I don't know that you could do it any other way than in second person.
Yeah, well, anyway, I actually didn't plan to start the book with the second person. It was when I first went into the head of the killer, if you will, and I realized second person would work, and then I decided, instead of opening the book on Myron talking to his parents on the phone, even though the FBI is right there and we have this DNA twist, so it gets right into it, I thought it'd be interesting to do a cold opening, if you will, of a murder from somebody you don't know who's the victim or who the perpetrator is, but it's, you know, hopefully you find it pretty clever the way it happened. And it's an introduction to what's about to start occurring.
You know, you've done so many TV things, or so many TV things have been made from your work and so forth. And I was trying to envision this one, and especially with the second person thing, exactly how that would translate to film. You know, because I mean, it's a totally different storytelling, not totally different. It is a different storytelling medium. And many of your books, I think, are naturally filmable. Some of them, I think, are more challenging. And this one, I think the structure of the book might make it. So I'll ask you the question we always get asked right now. Has there already been any film interest?
Well, it's a Myron book. So there's interest in a Myron TV series. We've been working on it for a little while over at Netflix, where I have a lot of my other shows.
Right.
So far, nothing to announce. I'm more wary of a Myron Bolitar series. Sure. For a lot of reasons. And one is, I don't want you to see an actor when you read it. And that's one of the reasons I've been a lot slower developing Myron than I have been with the other ones. The standalones, you know, for example, if you just watched Fool Me Once on Netflix, if you don't picture Michelle Keegan as Maya Stern, it doesn't really matter. This is only, it's her only book that she's going to be in. So that it's a different sort of a thing. I'm also not a big fan of series revolving around series characters. I love to read them. I don't necessarily like to watch them. So I'm a little more nervous. That said, you know, so Think Twice itself is not under development, but Myron in general is.
Gotcha.
But you raise another point, and that is that I never write the books thinking about a TV series. I get it, you know, people think, oh, you know, you must write them ready for them to be adapted. And it's never really the case. I think it's a real danger for a writer to write a book thinking, ooh, this will be a good TV series, this will be a good movie, because they're different mediums. The caveat I say to that is, I'm willing to change anything to make it, to make that adaptation. I don't worry about staying slavishly devoted to the text. In fact, I think the worst adaptations do. So I've moved countries, I've moved languages, I've changed genders of characters, I've gotten rid of whole plots, and I've added whole plots in. It's just a different medium. I can get inside Myron and Wynne's head a lot here, which is something I hope you, the reader, enjoy. You can't do that in a series. Everything has to be shown through action. And so it's just a different way of telling stories.
It is a different way, but he's talking to the person who sat with him when Tell No One was under negotiation to be bought. And Harlan was like bouncing up and down in his seat in incredulous tones on the phone, which would keep ringing. And then he'd come back and we'd say like 10 words, the phone would ring back. It was wonderful. I've always remembered that. It was just
almost 25 years ago.
It was so much fun to sit there with you.
It was the first time that happened for me too. Tell No One was a life-changing book in every way.
That's right.
New York Times bestseller, my first that breakout book in that movie deal where I realized maybe I could feed my children for the next year or two.
Well, you could. And, you know, if for those of you who've been reading him forever, Harlan was originally published as paperbacks back in the day. And, you know, paperback money is not enough money to allow the author to quit his day job. And so, you know, Tell No One was, a big turning point all the way around. And wonderful. I enjoyed the French film because it was actually French film rights, if I remember, that were.
Well, at that time, we were negotiating American film rights. And what actually happened, not to get into the weeds of how horrible Hollywood is, they wrote a terrible script after all that negotiating. And we finally wrote a terrible script that I really hated and had ideas that I just did not like. Changing the book, I don't mind changing the book, but changing the book in a way that just was not good.
Right.
And meanwhile, this young, crazy French director named Guillaume Canet is constantly getting me on the phone. I'm like, dude, it's done. It's being made in the U.S. And then I remember he always made me promise him if something happened, he could maybe try it. And I just loved his passion. I loved what he had to say. And Michael Apted was going to direct it, a well-known director, British director, here in Hollywood. And Guillaume Canet happened to be at an event with Michael Apted. And he said to Michael Apted, oh, man, you're making the book I still want to make into a film. And Apted said to him, it just fell apart. Like 2 days ago, it fell apart. Kenny runs to the phone, he calls me, and he says, it fell apart, can I have it? And I said to him, you know what, if you can match the option money, I'll sell to, even though the Americans thought I was crazy. But I just loved this guy's idea. And I knew that in France, they can't, you know, Hollywood, they can piss away a lot of money. France, they can't. So I knew we would make it. And, you know, it's one of those few times that I've gone with my gut. I usually am much more of a thinker, much more, I'm usually more rational about my decision making. But it ended up being one of the, you know, the fun and great things of my career. We love, you know, the movie's a classic. It's considered legendary. And Guillaume Canet did a wonderful job with it. And I had a great time with them making it.
Yeah, well, I loved it too. I thought it was so much fun. Anyway,
it's actually right now on Tubi for free. If you've never seen it, Tubi for free. So if you Google, put Telnow on Tubi, you can watch it for free.
Well, there you are. You can take that away from this conversation, if nothing else. Although you probably watch more of Harlan's things on Netflix, some of which have been filmed in the UK and whatever. I think your standalones, you know, I agree with you. The problem with the series character is that you give up a lot, whereas with a standalone, as you point out, you're just giving up one set of characters, so makes a difference. Anyway, back to this book. So thanks to Wynn and his private plane, we're able to assemble some characters in places where they don't actually live. I like the character of Bo, and I like the fact that, you know, how, I don't want to give anything away, but I liked how, who we think Bo has progressed as we move our way through the book. And I'm glad you did it that way. I'm glad I liked him, you know, and you don't start out liking him, but at the end you do like him. But I really liked his brother. And in fact, in the write-up that I sent out to everybody, I said, I really hope that Bo lands the coaching job, which Myron does try to make up to him, you know, for some of the things that happens by calling in a favor. And I hope, you know, I mean, we're not going to know that, but I really hope he gets the job.
Well, so I think one of the things you point out, these are minor characters, pretty small characters. Ooh. We'll stick to. But I try to make every character count. You try to do that. And so that both the scenes involving those characters could have been very one note. It could have been just sort of the threat, moving on, no guilt. But his reaction, what made you question if what Myron, or especially Wynn, was doing was ethical or not, would you do it? And I love that gray. And I love when, you know, you have the call back to that, and that it's not easy to forgive what happened and who's right and who's wrong. So you take, it's sort of one of the tricks that you try to do is you take a scene that it was just really to get information, right? This guy is coming in, he's going to give Myron and Wynn some important information. But instead, it turns into a whole story because the guy wouldn't react the way you want him to. And they had to get the information in a way that was more or less unethical. And so you as a viewer and a reader, in this case, have to make that decision and kind of follow along. So nothing is wasted. I learned that a long time ago. If it's a scene where you're just having a character come in to give you information, give that guy a full world, a full life.
Sure.
I try to tell my kids it's a human thing, too. I tell my kids, now they grow and they don't listen to me, not they listened before. But when you meet somebody new, it could be somebody who's on the streets or it could be somebody in a biggest mansion. Everyone has hopes and dreams. It's a simple thought, but just remember that person that you're looking at has hopes and dreams. And every character has hopes and dreams, even if I don't spend time with them, even if I don't go through it, I have to know what those hopes and dreams are. And is there a way? And in fact, in that case, there are, that guy has particular hopes and dreams, that I can use that to tell a story better and to make that character come to life better.
You do, absolutely. I mean, a lot of this book is really parent and child in various mutations. You know? So, I mean, you're a dad of four, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you've always been a very involved dad. And so I think, you know, I think that comes across in the story. But I also would say that I don't think Wynn suffers from too many shades of gray. Wynn's pretty able. I mean, Myron has, I think, more, you know, more gray in him than Wynn.
Yeah, as I go on in life, I realize there's more Wynn in me than I thought. I always thought I was just Myron and not really Wynn. But I think Wynn, the appeal for Wynn is that he is decisive in that way. He doesn't feel that guilt. He makes a decision and he goes away. And we kind of all want a Wynn in our life. But Wynn has changed over the years. I never want him to be politically correct or, you know, whatever terminology you want to use today for woke or politically correct. But he still can't be the guy that he was in 1995 when I started the series. And yet he's completely consistent with that guy. He's really been interesting to write as he's gone on and the world has changed around him. And he doesn't really change, but he gets it. And all those, that's what makes that makes the series so much more fun to write, that these guys age and change and it's current. So it's not to knock these books, we all love them, but the days of Hercule Poirot or Sherlock Holmes where the character never aged, never changed, just solved the crime, this has never held any interest to me. It's one of the reasons why I can't write that many Myrons. I've written 12 over the course now of almost 30 years. The reason I can't write more or want to do it forever is because I always want it to be really personal. This is a really personal story for Myron. It really brings up one of the worst nights of his life. It brings up an old romance. It brings up the fact that he has a son that he has virtually no relationship with. It brings up all these things that are in his past. And I want that every book. I never want a book where I've tried. I go, maybe this time Myron will just solve a case. I don't have anything to do with him personally. He'll just be that detective. And I just lose interest. So yeah. I always need to be personal.
That's really interesting. I remember having a conversation with Michael Conley after he'd written For Harry Bush, and we came to, I'm blanking on the fifth Harry Bush, where the body is found, you know, up on Mulholland or whatever it is. And Michael said to me, because, you know, we did his first ever event. He tells me when the time comes, we'll do his laughter. He almost terrified us in December by sitting down and saying he thought it was going to be his last book. And then he decided that he would instead back away from Hollywood and keep writing. My heart had stopped, you know, everybody in the place had gone, you know, when he said that. But anyway, the point was that what he said to me when we talked about that book, when he came to the store, was that he thought that he'd written four books that were personal to Harry. Every one of the four cases had been tied to Harry, particularly the fourth one, his search for his mother, and that Harry was the cop and he needed to have a book and an investigation that came to him just because he was a cop and, you know, caught that case, that it didn't have anything to do with him personally at all. So, you know, I think
two or three times I've tried that, but first of all, Myron's not a cop, so it's hard.
Right. No, I understand. Right.
But there's a couple that I've started that way, but eventually I just love it to have that personal reaction. And again, in the case of this book, the most common reaction I've gotten from people who have read it was the tear in the eye at the end. And
yeah,
it was just a case that involved him. If it didn't hit so close to home in the end, where he's actually going back home without giving anything away in a strange way, I don't think I get that. So I'm just not... That's why, you know, I like to age and change him. I mean, he doesn't age as fast as the rest of us do. But I do think it's more interesting. Now he and Wynne were slowly seeing some signs of aging, which I think is also healthy. I mean, if not my favorite series of all time, that Robert Parker Spencer mentioned again, you know, it got a little ridiculous that he fought in the Korean War and young girls are still checking him out on campus when he's in his 70s or whatever else. You know,
Careful, Harlan.
Yes. I'm right there. So, Libby, I go on
No,
campus.
You're not. I'm no much older than you are.
No one's checking me out on campus. But my point being that, you know, the fighting he was doing, and I always got a kick out of it. I still loved it. But Parker was trying to, which I think a lot of writers do, and I do to some degree also, was trying to have his cake and eat it too, where the guy was still a Korean War vet, and yet... Korean War vet would mean he'd be fighting in the late 40s, early 50s. And in the year 2000, he's still fighting bad guys. So he's in his 70s. It was, you know, it creaks a little bit. I'm already aging and changing Myron and Wynne slower, but I don't know how much longer they're going to be able to get in the kind of battles.
At the same time,
I'm delusional. I'm 62 and I think I could still beat up most people. So who knows?
There you are. Well, I do think that this book comes around in circles and, you know, with Myron's life. And as you point out, he is not a professional investigator. He's a sports agent. And so really, realistically, anything he investigates is going to have some sort of personal tie to him or a tie to somebody really, really close to him. Otherwise, why is he even in the game?
Right.
I completely agree with that. I'd also, I have to ask you, Have you, I'm trying to figure out how I can say this without a spoiler, but have you checked building codes in regard to Windows recently?
I'm trying to think what you're talking about there myself, but I guess the answer would be no.
No, I don't think so.
I'm assuming what you're talking about there myself, but you know, I finished this book 6 or 8 months ago. I've written, I think, you know, I've already started the next book. And I have an original TV series that is not based off a book that I've written, plus adapting 3 other shows at the same time. So I don't exactly remember the window reference. But
well, I'll email you because it would be a spoiler if I brought it up.
No, let's not go any farther.
Flicker through my mind.
Oh, maybe the very, very end. Oh, okay. I know what you mean. Nah, yeah. It's all right. It's fine.
It was very dramatic.
Not here anyway. So,
right. So Patrick, since Harlan has many things on his mind and places to go and things to do we have questions from the audience?
Yes, we do. Let's see. Well, Robin, our friend, says, Harlan, you're my 92-year-old mother-in-law, Mary's favorite author. She's in a nice facility in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and she shares her books with all the other fans there. And she asks, you know, is the book available in large print? Yes, it is. I sent her a link, but that's kind of sweet.
That is. Thank you very much. I love, you know, that's she sounds very smart and well-read.
A discerning reader. Oh, this is funny. Barbara and I were just talking about this the other day. Stefania from Italy. She would like to know if you have ever changed your writing process, and if yes, why?
Well, first of all, Stefania, you should be in bed. I mean, it's pretty late out there in Italy.
She's a vampire.
She is up all night.
Thank you for staying up with us late. You know, I don't know. I change up how I write a lot. It's weird. So recently I did a masterclass for a company called BBC Maestro, BBC, the English BBC Maestro. And I'm not trying to plug the class. It's like 5 hours long of me telling you all of the ways that I've learned to write over the years. And Lee Child did one, and Ken Follett did one, and Jojo Moyes did one. There's one on acting from like Brian Cox and Lena Bonham Carter. It's a lot of fun. My point being that it was interesting. I really didn't want to do it at first. And then when I decided to, how introspective I became on the process. So I have changed and I haven't. I think that as you get older, you sort of know where the pitfalls are a little better. But at the same time, you used up a lot of stuff. This was as hard a book. When I started writing Think Twice, I thought this was going to be not that hard to write. I thought revisiting Myron, I know these characters, I know the voices. And yet it was just brutal. So every time I sort of think I have it, it's a little bit, if you play golf, because golf's a little bit like this too, where you're playing well and you think you got it and all of a sudden your swing just disappears. So I'm constantly trying new things. So most of the time, like I write by hand. If I'm not writing well by hand, I go right on the computer. If I'm not writing well that way, I have white paper pads. I have yellow paper pads. I'll talk into my phone. That way rarely does it. I'll sometimes take walks. I'll do in the morning. When I was younger, I did a lot more writing at night. And I remember, you know, Patrick and I had an early convention many years ago. And I remember after talking to him, I actually went to my room and I wrote. I don't think I've written the past 7 or 8 p.m. other than toward the end of a book in years. Now I'm much, much better in the morning. When I had kids, I would have to leave the house. You just can't write in the house. And I use a lot of different places. If you ask 11 writers how they do it, you'll get 12 different answers, as Barbara and Patrick can tell you, because they've been listening to people talk like I have a long time. Like John Grisham, I did an event with John not that long ago. And John has a cabin behind his house that has no internet. And so he goes there at the same time every day, stays there the same amount of hours. You know, John's very, very anal and precise that way. I'm not so good about that. I'll go to one place, then I'll change up and go to another. Since COVID, I've been staying home. And now it's really weird. It sounds ridiculous, but I have 2 little dogs. And since COVID, when I leave the house for too long, they get really upset. So I feel guilty about leaving. So I write more at home than I used to. Those kind of things I change up. What I would tell you is, here's my writing philosophy or my writing rule or my writing process. If it helps me produce pages, good. If it doesn't help me produce pages, bad. And that's how I live my life. If it helps me produce pages, good. If it doesn't help me produce pages, bad. So whatever I'm doing, if it's not working, I got to change it up.
Wow. Can you talk a little bit about the space you're in right now? We've had a couple of people say that is such a cool looking place. Are you in? Yeah. Where are you?
I'm in my, I have a little, this is my house in Ridgewood, New Jersey. And wow. this is like, it used to be a greenhouse. And we just snapped up this glass room out here, which is great, especially in the winter time, because I feel like I'm outside, even though I'm inside. So it's a favorite room. And the sun was shining. There's a light that's kind of acting like the sun, but I can't figure out how to tilt it so it goes away. So this is I guess you call it a sunroom off of the kitchen of my house.
That's really cool. Janet says, Harlan, I love your books and the shows on Netflix too, but I really enjoyed reading about you in Michael J. Fox's book. So now I also think of you as a golf uncle. What's that a reference to?
So Michael J. Fox was one of my dearest friends. In fact, we were at the New York Rangers game a couple nights ago, watching the Rangers beat Carolina Hurricanes together. We go to a fair amount of hockey games. We do a golf trip, at least, you know, we used to do it once a year in the wintertime, and we golfed a lot together over the last decade, I would say. And it was mostly golf for me is about the conversations and hanging with friends. And so when Michael wrote Mike was going to write a book, his most recent book was going to be about our golf times and just on our golf times. And he started to get ill again, had some real tough tough physical ailments that came up. And so he decided to make the book more about that with the golf references. So there's a few times he has to tease me about certain things in the book. And like he tells a story of the time he outdrove me and just kind of walked past my ball and said, I think you're away, even though I'm quite a bit bigger than he is. The only other thing I'll add about Mike, because I know everyone loves him and it's right to. I think that it's interesting that a lot of the actors or people who I know that are beloved are actually beloved people. You can't fake Mike's authenticity. He's always
that really comes across.
Yeah,
when you hear him speak.
But he never has a false moment, and I'm really proud or thrilled to be, you know, his friend. I see him probably once a week or every other week, and they saw each other three times last week. We had a lot of stuff doing, and he's always fascinating. He's always interesting. He's really well read, by the way. He's read everything, so I'm sure. Everybody, you know, he knows all the people in the shop. When I first met him, he had already read almost all of my books. He's extraordinarily smart. He's extraordinarily kind, and has not been easy. For him, he stopped with the optimism. He's not always that as optimistic as he was. He admits that this last couple of years has been a rough ride. And I recommend the movie. There's a movie on his life called Still on Apple TV, which I think reflects a lot of Mike's spirit. You could really, that to me, what I loved about that movie was that's the Mike that I know.
Have you ever considered giving him like a little cameo on one of your TV adaptations?
Oh, I'm dying to get him to come over. He was going to do one in New Jersey, but he couldn't when we were doing this last one. I want to give him a part. You know, he's still, as a friend, Michael's skill set is he delivers a line like nobody else. This is going to sound very name droppy, like I'm just dropping names here, but I'm doing a show in England with the actor Bill Nye, N-I-G-H-Y, the older actor who was in Love Actually, unbelievable actor, been in a million movies, was nominated for an Oscar 2 years ago, I think, for Best Actor. And I was talking to Bill, who didn't know I knew Mike, and he was one day saying that the two best, most underrated actors were Michael J. Fox and Ted Danson, because they can deliver a comedy line like nobody else's business. And Mike does that in person too. He has that timing, that look, the delay. He, you know, and being very, very quick.
Oh, so does Bill Nye. Gosh, he is just a marvelous actor.
Yeah, so it's gonna be a fun show. I'm doing a show for Prime that stars Bill and Sam Claflin, who you may know recently from the Daisy Jones TV series, also Me Before You movie and Hunger Games. The younger women out there especially seem to know who he is. My daughter's freaked out. And they play a father-son in this, it's a little bit of a supernatural tinge series that I'm filming right now right now we're calling it Lazarus. We'll see what it ends up being, the title. And that was an original idea that's not based off a novel.
Now, I know, I have to ask, because I know that you and our mutual, well, he's a friend to you, he's, you know, Nils Lofgren, who lives here in the Phoenix, Scottsdale area, you know, the guitarist for the E Street Band, and what a sweet guy.
He loves your store. My God, he's always, every time I see him, he's like,
a regular customer.
He comes all the time to you guys. Huge mystery reader, as you know. I'm sorry I interrupted you, Patrick, but
point
out that he loves your store. First time he came was when I was there visiting. And he's just like, what? It was like he walked into Nirvana. He's been a steady customer since, I know. Now it's 20
years.
He's
great. Yeah. He always, you know, he'll come in and ask me, you know, anything I like, come in, you know, and yeah. So
just do both of you know that he wrote a blurb for James Lee Burke's new book, Cleat?
Oh, did he?
I just quoted it. I just sent out a piece to our customers, and in it, I quoted Nils on Cleat, on James Lee Burke, and said, you know, what a neat guy he was, and how he was such a long term customer. One of my dreams has always been to get you and Nils together at the store at the same time. But that, when he's touring, you know, with the band, Springsteen, it always seemed to work out that when you came to the store, he was also, you know, he was away on tour. But maybe eventually we can achieve that. That would be great.
I just got a text from, I think, yesterday, that they're in somewhere in Europe. He particularly likes Myron, so he was excited that he gets very excited because he's a reader boy.
He really is.
He loves when the series comes back. He's been a big Myron guy for a long time.
I turned him on to Joe Lansdale a bunch of years ago, and he's become a big fan.
He loves those kind of, he loves those kind of series books. I think I probably told you a story when I met him. So this is going back to 1998 or 99, before Tell No One, before I was a very big seller. And Springsteen had just come back. It was that first reunion tour. And they were playing here in New Jersey. And I was at home and my phone rang. And one of the guys, they said, is this Harlan Coben? I'm like, yes. He goes, this is backstage at Bruce Springsteen. Nils Lofgren wants to talk to you. Because he had been reading one of my books and somebody told him, oh, he lives right down the street in New Jersey. And one of the guys in the band knew who I was. And Nils gets on the phone and goes, hey, Harlan. I'm like, hi, Nils. Like, I thought it was one of my friends playing a joke on me. He says, yeah, you want to come down tomorrow night and we can hang before the show and, you know, go to the sound check and all that. I'm like, hold on, let me see my wife. Honey, you want to go? And like, I was absolutely freaked out. And this is at 99, so it's over 25 years ago. And he and I have been, I went that night and he and I have been friends since. And it wasn't too many years later. I think it was maybe 3 years later, 4 years later, I was in Phoenix at your store and he came by and that's when you guys all first met him. So yeah, an interesting guy. But he had found the books at a small store in Ireland, he told me, but the paperback original Myron's he started on. So it was a thing. I always think that. I remember I went to Dublin, I went to that store and he told me who this old man was who worked at the store who told him. And I went and thanked him for recommending my book to people.
I love that. I found the quote for the James Lee Burke. I just looked it up. A stunning work. Get this now. It will take you apart and heal you. Lord, what a magnificent book. Nils Lofgren.
That's a great description of James Lee Burke's books in general. Wow, that's great.
It really is. Isn't it interesting that he won? I think it's his fourth Edgar.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
I was there for the third one.
It's the most by anybody for best one.
Yeah, absolutely true. For the one last year, Flags on the Bayou, not for Cleat, which doesn't come out till June. But Nils is great. Every once in a while, he brings us all presents, you know, work tapes or some such thing.
Yeah, he's a
wonderful
album out,
soul. He's just got a kind aura, don't you think, Patrick?
Yeah, he's just so generous and cool.
He's got like a kind aura around him.
He really does. Yeah.
Anything else there, Patrick?
Let's see here. Probably. You got a lot of great fans out here.
Thank you. Talk to everybody.
Let me jump over on YouTube real quick here. Diane says, I enjoy the subtle threads that connect to many of your books. But there were, you've addressed this, there were a number of people have asking about, is it necessary to read the books in order? And No.
I'm right? against it. I'm actually, first of all, I don't think Deal Breaker, which is the first in the series, is my strongest book. And by now, of course, you know, it's a snapshot of 1993 or four when I wrote it. I think you'd be better off, and I think people get more of enjoyment, and then you sort of see how it develops. So you can see the book when he first meets Greg Downing, who in this book is the guy who's dead and appears in two other books. But I think sometimes it's more fun to go out of order. And I think about this a lot, because not just for books, but I think most of your TV shows, especially growing up, because we never had, you know, we didn't have streaming services then. We watched out of order all the time. Most of our shows that we fell in love with, we didn't find on the pilot episode. You never heard of the show then. It was 7-8 weeks in. And
that's
so
a great point.
Yeah. I think there's a certain enjoyment you have. Like, I write a book sometimes out of order. I one of the pieces of advice I gave people in the BBC Maestro masterclass was to start a book in the middle. You know, don't start at the beginning. And you can always go back or forward, but there's a joy to that also, to be here and to see how you made that journey rather than just not knowing blindly where you go. That also might sound very self-serving right now, but either way, you're going to read it. Read me, I hope. So I would suggest, yes, I don't think you'll be lost at all. And all the comments I've seen, no one has felt like they were lost. So,
no, I don't think so. Actually, one of the reasons Harlan's such an interesting writer is that he does write series and he does write standalones, because some authors lock themselves into one lane. You know, they either write a series or they only write standalones because they, you know, they're more interested in world building and they've been so destructive to somebody's life that, you know, bringing them back doesn't really work. The story's over. But I've always found it interesting that you go from one to another. So let me ask you about the short story and then we'll sign off here. Do you find that the short form works for you too?
In terms of, I don't write short stories. I mean, I've written three, I think, in my life.
Right.
One was about my father's death too. That was not a mystery. It was just it's for the New York Times op-ed page. I'm not a short story guy, but I do, when I'm deciding between a Myron and a Wynn, for the most part, I don't decide ahead of time. I think of an idea, and then I wonder who's going to tell that story. So, you know, I wrote seven straight Myron books when we first met in the 90s.
Right.
And then I came up with this idea about a man and a woman who were happily married. The wife is murdered. 8 years pass. He gets an email. He clicks a hyperlink. He sees a webcam. And his dead wife walks by. And I love this idea. It became Tell No One. But obviously, Myron couldn't tell it. Myron didn't have a wife who died 8 years ago. So then I say, who's going to tell it? I came up with Dr. David Beck. So each book, I kind of start that way. This one a little bit more, though, I think I was sort of ready to see Myron again. I think I kind of wanted the comfort in this world where everything seems to be turning upside down, where whatever side of the political aisle you're on, we are being overtaken by extremists on both the right and the left. And it feels like our country is being torn apart in a way that I've never seen in my lifetime, that I kind of wanted the comfort food and nostalgic feeling of how I felt when I read a Parker book or a Raymond Chandler book or a Sue Grafton book or a Michael Connelly book, or, you know, one of those sort of comfort food, fantastic, but that kind of a thing. And I really wanted to give that to the readers, where you're just going to forget the world for a few hours. And that's my sincere hope that what's what happens right. with Think Twice.
Integrity is valued and things like that.
Yeah.
It's not just comfort, it's also certainty. I think, you know, because that's the other thing, is that, you know, at the end, there is certainty to this story, the way you're going to tell it. And we have so much uncertainty right now to deal with for God knows how long that I think that makes a difference. Well, Harlan, it's been a real pleasure.
Always great to see you, Barbara and Patrick, and everybody out there who stayed and listened to this. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it. And if you do read it, feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, and I will read that comment. I'd love to see what you guys thought. Thanks.
It'll be great. We only have, seriously, the books will probably arrive tomorrow. We can't sell it to you till Tuesday, but we only have a few copies left. So hurry up, order yours. Right. Night, everybody.
Take care,
Night.
Everybody.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.